Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Dave Barmby and me, Tony Gosling. We go back 68 years now into the heat of World War II as the Allies were fighting towards Germany. Ask, why did the tanks of the British Guards Armoured Division at Nijmegen Bridge take a 17-hour break instead of pressing ahead to Arnhem along an almost open road to relieve the surrounding British paratroopers at Arnhem Bridge? So we go back now to nearly 70 years to the Dutch town of Arnhem. It's World War II, several months after the successful Normandy D-Day invasion, and Hitler is on the back foot on the Western Front. The British and American forces are forcing the Nazi troops slowly back towards Germany. It was early morning in Holland on Sunday the 17th of September 1944, and as the gliders and paratroopers poured down along a 60-mile corridor to hold the bridges, the furthest bridge from the front line, Arnhem, became the focus of attention overnight, as the biggest airborne operation in history unfolded. But our question this evening, was it really a bridge too far, as the title of Cornelius Ryan's book and Robert E. Levine's famous films imply? Or could the tanks and ground troops of 30 Corps have gotten through to relieve the surrounded British paratroopers at Arnhem when, with Arnhem only 10 kilometres, a 20-minute drive away and virtually clear road ahead, the tanks inexplicably halted for 17 hours. By the time the tanks started rolling, the British paratroopers ran out of ammunition and were forced to surrender, and the German panzer reinforcements had arrived to block the way. Well, this is a topic that I've been researching for a few months now, partly at the behest of an occasional guest on this show, Dave Barmby, who joins me again now. Hi, Dave. Welcome
Hello,
to Drive Tony. Time.
Nice to meet you again.
Now, first of all, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well,
I'm going to start by saying something about you, which was you got to know David Cameron, didn't you, over in Whitney, as he was becoming just trying to get to stand as a parliamentary candidate.
He was seeking to be the PPC for Whitney back in 2000, and being in the Conservative Party, I got interested in this guy because we just got rid of Sean Woodward, who defected, and I thought, well, this might be a good guy. And he came round to my house at my behest and talked to me about what he stood for.
And what did he stand for?
I'm not sure now.
Anyway, you're no longer with the Conservative Party. Is that part of the disillusionment with David?
I left in 2007 and joined another party.
Go on, which party? Come on, don't be shy.
We don't need to go into that. It's got nothing to do with what we're talking about tonight, okay?
Yeah, but I mean, I think, also you're an engineer, is that right?
Yeah, my career has been in telecommunications engineering from 1956, when I worked at Marconi, a company which has gone down the chute due to Lord Simpson, who started betting with the company, and we lost a magnificent company which had a proud history. And would have provided the radio sets, no doubt, for Arnhem.
But the ones that didn't work, because that was one of the problems, wasn't it?
I've got something to say about that.
Go on then, let's say it now.
You want to say it now? Well, you've got to remember, radio sets contain loads of valves, which are glass envelopes, for those who have never heard of a valve, with sensitive elements inside. And a lot of the gliders which landed with this kit would have often turned over, and some of the radios, I would have thought, might have got damaged or became intermittent. And I suspect, but I can't prove it, that this might have had something to do with very poor communications in Arnhem itself. But there was also poor communications between the corps leaders, particularly Boy Browning, Lieutenant General Boy Browning, who's in charge of the three divisions that landed at Eindhoven, Nijmegen and Arnhem.
Okay, so by way of introduction, let's hear Sir Brian Urquhart's introduction to the campaign. He was one of the Army intelligence officers involved with the planning, and he later became Secretary General of the newly created United Nations. So let's have a listen to his introduction to what this Arnhem campaign back in September 1944 was all about.
This was, I think, the most traumatic experience of my life. I was the chief intelligence officer of the British Airborne Corps, which was the British parachute and glider troops. Having been badly damaged, I couldn't do any more parachuting, so I became a staff officer. It was called Operation Market Garden. It was the largest airborne operation ever launched in history, and I think more aircraft were in the air for that operation than any time before or since. It was one of those operations which grew bigger and bigger as the ambitions of the generals steadily swelled. And it was, I'm sorry to say, I think very largely an indictment of Field Marshal Montgomery, who was the British commander in Europe. This is after the invasion of Normandy. The Allied troops had taken Paris, and they had just taken Brussels. And the winter was coming on. It was September 1944. And Montgomery wanted to have a glorious coup to end the war in 1944. Nobody except him, I think, really believed in this, certainly not General Eisenhower, and certainly not Eisenhower's staff. But Montgomery was a very, very dominating figure and a great pain in the neck when he wanted something that other people didn't want to give him. And he went on and on about it. The idea was to have an airborne operation which would take the three great bridges over the Rhine Delta in Holland and land the Allied armies on the other side ready to preside over the surrender of Germany. To do this, they had one British airborne division, two American airborne divisions, the 82nd and the 101st, and the whole Allied Air Force. But in order to do it, they had to stop General Patton, who was going great guns in the south, because Montgomery had failed to capture Antwerp. So there was only one supply port for the entire Allied Expeditionary Force, which was Cherbourg, miles and miles away in France. Which meant they couldn't ship in enough gasoline to run two mobile operations at the same time. So Patton was stopped when there was very little in front of him, which I think was a huge mistake. Mm-hmm. And we embarked on this really very risky airborne operation. My job as chief intelligence officer was to try to evaluate what the enemy reactions were going to be and how our troops ought to deal with them. And I became increasingly alarmed, first of all, at the German preparations, because the Germans had right next to where the British airborne troops were going to be dropped, which was the far end of the operation at Arnhem. It was across the third bridge, so there were three bridges to capture before you got to the British airborne troops. And there were intelligence reports that there were two SS Panzer divisions. These were the star troops of the German army, the 10th and the 9th. SS Panzer divisions were refitting in this area. They had been very badly mauled in Normandy. These were the best fighting troops in the German army, and they had heavy tanks. Airborne troops in those days had no heavy weapons, no supplies, very limited supplies of ammunition, and they could not fight heavy armor because they didn't have the weapons to do it. I was also equally upset about the state of mind of the senior officers in my outfit, who were all extremely gung-ho and were talking about Christmas in Berlin and this kind of thing. Somebody said they were going to take their golf clubs because it was going to be a pushover. Mm-hmm. And this seemed to me to be extremely dangerous, because the German army, in fact, is not an army to surrender without being told to do it. And furthermore, these were the best troops in the German army. And I tried to get this point of view across and to point out that this was an extremely risky operation. And that if we were going to do it properly, we would have to drop the troops in a different place so that they could immediately capture the bridge. And that there was a big question as to whether the relieving troops could get up from near Brussels. They were stuck on the Albert Canal, which was 60 miles away. And the country there is flat dike country. The roads are all causeways. Mm-hmm. These are perfect roads for an armored force to stop another force from advancing. Mm-hmm. All you've got to do is to disable one tank. That mm-hmm. blocks the whole thing. Well, I didn't get anywhere with this. Everybody thought that I was hysterical, nervous, and so on.
Well, hysterical or not, that was Sir Brian Urquhart, who later became, not to be confused with the Urquhart, Dave, is it, from the 1st Airborne Division?
General Urquhart was in charge of the 1st Airborne Division.
So we got two Urquharts, one of whom was an intelligence officer back in London, the other one was actually on the ground in Arnhem.
Well, I think Brian Urquhart would have been in on the operation if he hadn't got fired.
Probably.
There's one thing I don't quite agree with him there. He... he talks about the airborne forces not having any heavy weapons. Well, they didn't have huge heavy weapons, but they did have weapons which could take out tanks.
And yeah, they had anti-tank guns, they had mortars, yeah, certainly they had some transport as well.
They had 7-pounders. They used that to take out the armour on the Arnhem Bridge on the second day of the day after the drop, which was the 18th.
Okay, well, just introduce us then to this situation in Lent, because there was the second of the three bridges was captured, and then there was a whole debacle, wasn't there, between the Americans and the British. The British being the tanks, basically, at least attempting anyway to make that last step to Arnhem.
Yeah. Well, yes, I mean, reading all the accounts, and that's all we can do. We weren't there, so we can only sit down as armchair generals. I think what happened, deducing, is that four tanks led by Sergeant Robinson went across the bridge at behest of his commanding officer, which was Major Trotter, and he went across the bridge with four tanks, got across to the other side of the bridge, and carried on another mile to Lent. And he talked about meeting the Americans at the bridge, and I'd always thought it was the railway bridge, and it was actually a railway bridge over the Vaal, but it was actually a railway bridge over the road in Lent, a mile on, and they're only 8 miles from Arnhem at that stage, and it was only later that Carrington, who was second in command of the squadron, which
this is Lord Carrington, who was Defence Secretary later, wasn't he?
Well, he was not only he was certainly Foreign Secretary. He may have been Defence Secretary, but he was also Secretary General of NATO in the 80s. He was also, for 6 years, Chairman of the Bilderbergers.
So he was sitting in one of these tanks that had just got across, the first tanks to cross the penultimate bridge before Arnhem, when he was confronted by Moffat Burrys and a load of American soldiers. So let's just listen now to a little clip from Robert E. Levine's film A Bridge Too Far, which portrays this little incident where the Americans were essentially saying, look guys, don't hang around here, you need to get off up to Arnhem. So let's have a listen to that now.
I don't understand, why aren't you moving? What's the matter with you guys?
Those are British troops at Arnhem. They're hurt bad. You're not going to stop. Not now.
I'm sorry, we have our orders.
We busted our asses getting here. Half my men are killed, and you're just going to stop and drink tea?
Look, we're now facing a completely different situation. We can't leave with tanks up that road. Jerry will pick us off like sitting ducks. Our infantry are still fighting in Nijmegen. When they get here, we'll move on.
For Christ's sake, must you do everything but a book?
Our orders are to wait for the infantry. I'm sorry, but there it is.
Yes, that was the confrontation portrayed in the film, A Bridge Too Far. We had, sort of reminder here, we had Dirk Bogarde, Sean Connery, Ryan O'Neill, Gene Hackman, Edward Fox, Michael Caine, Anthony Hopkins, real pretty much a star-studded cast, Hardy Kruger and Maximilian Schell there. I mean, what's your thoughts about the film, Dave? Do you think otherwise, that incident is clearly portrayed as a clash, isn't it?
Well, I think you have to backtrack slightly there. I saw the film very soon after it came out. Was it 20 years ago? And when I saw that river crossing, it seemed to me fictional. I didn't actually believe. I thought it was just something added for spice to the film. It was only about 4 years ago when I first started looking at this subject, because I'm interested in military history, that I realised it was a real, live, actual event. And you've got to remember that the 504th Regiment, which was led by Major Cook.
This is the American paratroopers, part of the 82nd Airborne Division,
right,
in Nijmegen.
They were detailed by Horrocks, and Horrocks made a promise to their commanding officer of the regiment, Colonel Tucker, that if they took on this dangerous operation in daylight to attack across the Vaal under fire from heavy German forces and go and wipe them out and then take the other side of the bridge, Horrocks promised that the British tanks, the Grenadier Guards and so forth, would belt off up the 8 or 9 miles to Arnhem and establish a proper bridgehead.
Now, Moffat Burries was one of the people in charge of that river crossing, and lost about half of his men. Yeah. And he's still alive, isn't he? He also wrote a book called Strike and Hold.
Yeah, I've got that book here, actually.
And I'll tell you what, I've interviewed Moffat Burries. I managed to get hold of him in the States. So let's have a listen now to him, who was there, his version of what happened.
My name is Moffat Burries. I was a captain in 3rd Battalion, 504 Parachute Regiment, and commanded I Company, which is one of the two assault companies that made the river crossing and captured the bridge at Nijmegen. When we were first advised that we were going to be in that battle, we went up in this tall building, a factory electrical plant building, with General Horrocks and General Browning, Colonel Tucker, and the officers from the four company commanders of the S3 of the 3rd Battalion 504, and made a visual reconnaissance and of looking over the river and over the pasture and the dike where the machine guns were, railroad bridge where the 20 millimeter gun was. And I remember General Horrocks explaining the critical situation of the British troops in Arnhem, and that if we didn't get there and give them some assistance at the bridge, that in a matter of hours, all would be lost. And I remember Colonel Tucker responding to a comment that General Horrocks made when he said, General Horrocks asked Tucker, "Can your lads do the job? Can they get the bridge?" Colonel Tucker said, "Let me ask you a question, General. If we take that bridge, what assurance do we have from you that your tanks will be lined up for Arnhem in force?" And Horrocks, and I can remember his remarks as if they were yesterday, said, "My tanks will be lined up in full force, hell-bent for Arnhem, and nothing will stop them." That's not what happened. One gun stopped them. After we crossed the river and had 50% casualties in that crossing and made it up to the dike, knocked out the machine guns, and went on and captured the north end of the bridge, four British tanks came across. The lead tank was knocked out, and the other three backed up to the bridge. And I went to the commander of that task force, which was Captain Carrington, and said, "Why are you stopping?" And he said, "Well, I can't go up there. That gun will knock out the rest of my tanks." I said, "We will go with you and get that gun." He said, "No, I can't go without orders." And I said, "Well, I'm giving you orders." And an American captain giving a British captain orders went over like a lead balloon. And so he said, "No, I have to have orders from my British from my British commander." Well, about that time, my frustration was turning to anger. And I can't repeat on the air what I said to him at that time, but it was not very complimentary. And they sat there all night, even after Colonel Tucker and Major Cook came and had a similar conversation with him. "Why aren't you moving on? There's only one gun left." And what I couldn't understand, just a few hours before that, Horrocks had told us very explicitly, "My tanks will be lined up in full force, hell-bent for Arnhem." Four tanks went across, not all of his tanks, not 10, not 20, not 40 tanks, but four tanks went across. And when one got knocked out, they backed up and stopped. Why did they do that? I don't know. The information I have been told was that Carrington said his orders were to take the bridge and hold it for further orders. That was not what Horrocks told us the orders would be. So we were very, very frustrated, sitting there all night, having sacrificed half of the men of my company to try to rescue the British paratroopers. We knew what it was like for paratroopers to fight Tiger tanks. We'd done it all through Sicily and Italy and the rest of the war, and it is not a comfortable feeling. So we had a great deal of compassion for the British paratroopers that were being mauled by the Tiger tanks. To send four tanks across, and he has an entire corps of tanks in Nijmegen, is just beyond belief. We were expecting to see the tanks roaring across the bridge at full speed, and that didn't happen. I can understand the 10 tanks that were supporting us when we were making the river crossing. Maybe I'd been told they were not there because they had expended all of their ammunition. But the rest of the tanks that were in Nijmegen, there should have been a full force of them going across that bridge and headed for Arnhem. The airborne paratroopers in Arnhem were just hanging on by their fingernails, and that was known by Horrocks and the other troops in Nijmegen. And why they would let that one gun stop them is just beyond belief to me.
That was Captain Moffat T. Burris, author of Strike and Hold, and who was commanding a company that made that famous Vaal crossing. Dave, you know, his testimony there is pretty much, he was there, you know, and he's saying essentially that no one could really believe. Do you think it's possible that maybe that the generals told him that they were going to be charging up the road in order to sort of get him going to do the crossing in the first place?
Well, I, that doesn't really make sense, because if that's all they wanted him to do, cross the river and not do anything about it, why send him in the first place? Or at least, if you're not going to do anything about the following up on his success, or Moffat Burris and the rest of the companies, that was H&I company, then why not do it at night, where you reduce the casualties to a minimal amount? But the fact is, there was no follow-up, and this is a big black hole that remains to be understood.
Well, I pressed Moffat Burris a bit on the confrontation with Carrington, because there's a lot of rumours around that. This is Lord Carrington sitting in his Grenadier Guards tank, as Moffat Burris, having lost half his company, comes up and sees him sitting there when he really does expect him to go charging down the road. So let's see what Moffat Burris had to say about that.
I was talking to Carrington. He was sitting in his tank, and we were having this argument about him not moving out. When he failed to move, and I ordered him to, and he still failed to move, I cocked my Tommy gun and put it to his head and told him if he didn't get this blankety-blank tank moving, I'd blow his head off. And with that, he ducks down into the tank, closes the hatch, and sits there the rest of the night, couldn't get to him. As I understand, Carrington denies that anybody pulled a gun on him, but his memory is not quite as good as mine if he really believes that. I bumped into Carrington at the 65th anniversary celebration at a reception that we're having for the Queen, and as he walked up, General Petraeus was, and I were talking, and he introduced me to Carrington, and I said, "Well, we know each other. We met on the bridge 65 years ago." And Carrington turned and looked at me, and he said, "Oh, you're the chap that called me a yellow-livered coward." And I said, "Is that what I called you?" And he said, "Yes." And said, "You didn't really expect me to follow the orders of a foreign government, did you?" And I said, "Of course I did." And then it went on to some small talk from that point.
That's Moffat Burris again, who's a veteran of that campaign. Dave, what do you think about what Carrington's putting there? I mean, just to make it clear, I did actually put an interview request into the House of Lords to see if Lord Carrington wanted to contribute but didn't get any reply. What he's saying there, Moffat Burris, is essentially on what Carrington is saying, is that it's a foreign army. Why should I take orders from a captain, even though he's the same rank as me? He's from the American army, not the British army.
Well, I would have expected that there would have been cooperation, that Carrington would have seen the effort that had been put in and the deaths and that had happened to half of the his company and the other company that were crossed over, and he would have played ball. But we do see Moffat Burris in his book Strike and Hold backing off a bit from what he said on that interview. He did start to...
Well, maybe he's taking one step further than what he said in the book, because you can't necessarily write down in the book what you're going to tell someone on the phone, can you? There is a big book about this, one of the things that's got you and I both interested in. That's Robert Kershaw's book. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
I've never read it.
This is It Never Snows in September. Lots of little bits and pieces
from
it.
Well, I know. I've taken excerpts from it, which...
Robert...
Which described this part of the battle, and this is mostly about the German perspective on this episode.
This whole situation, yeah. Because what we had certainly up until the Bridge Too Far film pretty much was exclusively the view of the Allies on this.
I think we should backtrack a bit.
Well, can you hang on a second, Dave? Yeah. We'll do that in a minute, but we're going to hear now from Robert Kershaw, who wrote this book, It Never Snows in September, all about this whole campaign, but from the German point of view, that is talking to German veterans who were there.
My name is Robert Kershaw, and I'm the author of It Never Snows in September, which I wrote some time ago when I was still serving in the army. I speak and read German. I attended the German Staff College, and I was requested by the British Staff College to see if I could assist them with a battlefield tour that they were doing with British veterans in and around Arnhem. And the question for me was, could I interview some Germans or find some Germans for them to attend and be interviewed? Well, in the event, that was not possible. And I was actually working with the German army, the Bundeswehr, at the time. And they agreed to get information together for this particular event. And a whole flood of very personal papers, letters, and accounts came in, which fascinated us all, and that was the stuff that I used on an initial battlefield tour in Arnhem, and much later they persuaded me subsequently to write a book and include all this material.
Now, your book isn't quite as famous as Cornelius Ryan's A Bridge Too Far. Maybe it wasn't A Bridge Too Far.
The Cornelius Ryan book was a process where he employed a lot of researchers to get him the information. He was an ex-correspondent, a very good writer, but he was really writing accounts that had been gathered by many other researchers as well. And a lot of myth has since grown up, primarily as a consequence of his book and the slightly inaccurate interpretation of it that came with the big film A Bridge Too Far. I remember speaking with a British military advisor who worked with Joseph E. Levine on that film, and he said, just bear in mind, Colonel, the chap was an ex-retired colonel, I make films for money, not for history. And that is very true, and there are incidents within the film that have been glossed over for their dramatic effect and are not particularly accurate. The operation was a huge risk, and I think probably the Allies at the time were justified in taking it. A lot of the comment about Arnhem has been with the benefit of armchair hindsight, and you really got to try and get back to the times when the German army was visibly collapsing after the debarque in Normandy. They'd retreated in great haste into southern Holland, and it appeared that just one more shove would bring the whole edifice crashing down. The British airborne formations waiting for action in the UK were itching for a chance to get into the fight, and this particular division hadn't seen action into Italy about a year and a half before, and they felt that the war might indeed be passing them by. They'd been stood up for a large number of operations that actually hadn't happened. So they were very anxious to get in. And with the information that was available, it appeared, despite factual data, that there were German units consolidating in around Arnhem, there was a feeling, okay, but they would probably be swept aside in the next major offensive.
Now, Dave, Robert Kershaw's book is really throwing a whole new light on it, and he's also saying that essentially that the plan possibly could have worked. I mean, is that something you would agree with?
I'm not a general, I'm not a planner, but I can read accounts and come to my own conclusions. And reading extracts from Kershaw's book, it becomes pretty plain to me that the operation could have succeeded, even in spite of the cock-ups by the generals, the egos getting in the way of proper planning and cooperation. It was clear from Kershaw's book that there was plenty of... there was not the armaments, there was not the military forces in the island, which is between the North and South Rhine, between Nijmegen and Arnhem, to put up sufficient resistance to stop 60 tanks coming through, which is what was available according to the battle order.
Okay, so yes, but I mean the thing is that it's always a bit confusing. Mm. Moffat Burrows has said that Nijmegen was in flames at the time, so you can't necessarily pull all those or even necessarily any of those tanks ready to reinforce the ones that have already got across the bridge.
Well, I think the battle zone was divided up. The rest of the 504th Regiment, or the 82nd Division, were holding off the Germans in Groesbeck Heights, and there was a cordon sanitaire, so to speak. So the attack could take place across the bridge quite safely because it was held back. And if you read Carrington's report, he charged across the bridge about 2 hours after Sergeant Robinson had gone across with his troop of tanks, and he couldn't find Robinson. That's because Robinson had gone another mile up the road towards Arnhem, stopped in Lent, where he'd fought a battle there, and eventually 2 hours later Carrington joined up with them. And Carrington will say, or says in his account, that at that time a load of other tanks came up, so there seemed to be a force, but something stopped them in Lent, which was only 8 miles away from Arnhem, and was, if it had gone on, it would take another 20 minutes, assuming they didn't get shot at. And according to Kershaw's accounts, and he's reporting on the Germans' account, Hamel, that there was nothing to stop them.
Now, you've mentioned Heinz Hamel. He was the SS general in charge of the 10th SS Panzer Division, which was in charge of the defence of both the Nijmegen Bridge and the Arnhem Bridge. Okay. And Robert Kershaw interviewed and met Heinz Hamel, and in a way, that's one of the reasons why we're here now, is because his account of events has thrown all sorts of new light on what actually happened. So let's go back now and hear Robert Kershaw.
Once they had captured the bridge, and this is debatable, they could conceivably have pushed an armoured infantry group up the road to reach Arnhem. But at the same time, the Arnhem Bridge had just been captured by the Germans. So in any event, both captures were a hollow victory. But I interviewed the German SS general, Hamel, who was responsible for the defence of the bridge, and he gave me an artillery map. And artillery maps will always show the location of friendly units. And it's obvious from this particular map and his statements that there was very little on the road between Nijmegen and Arnhem at that time. In fact, there appears to be only a couple of companies of infantry security pickets in the village of Elst, which is midway between the two. So it is just conceivable that they may have been able to push an armoured battle group up that road. Hamel thinks so, because he very sarcastically said, and the British stopped for tea. And that's the version also that the Americans would have you believe. I'm an armchair strategist, talking in hindsight, and he was the man there at the time. If he says that the psychological impact of a unit pushing down that road could have been decisive, then I think, you know, you have to listen. That is quite possible. Fact and fiction over these sort of, you know, 60-odd years will always tell a different story. Harmel was a very clear and precise man. He gave the impression, when he spoke to me, he was smoking a huge cigar, puffing smoke all over me, and he gave me a very clear exposition of his defence of Nijmegen and Arnhem. He was responsible for both bridges because it made sense. One was reinforcing the other. And he told me things that were not in Cornelius Ryan's book, and I pointed this out to him. And he actually said to me, well, I told Cornelius Ryan this stuff, and he interpreted it in a different way. For example, I pointed out that Harmel was in the bunker and able to see the Nijmegen Bridge, and he said, well, no, I wasn't in the bunker. I was actually conducting the battle from a Volkswagen Jeep, because he was switching between the two locations. He had to fight the Arnhem Bridge free and defend the Nijmegen Bridge. So he was driving up and down the 10 kilometres between the two locations, constantly coordinating the battle. So, being a soldier myself, all that had a ring of truth to it. So, what he told me, I found interesting and probably authentic.
That's Robert Kershaw's interesting little encounter and interview with Heinz Harmel, the commander of the 10th SS Panzer Division. Dave, you were disagreeing with what he was saying there a little bit, particularly when he said about the two bridges falling at the same time, the Arnhem Bridge falling to the Germans at the same time as the Nijmegen Bridge fell to the Americans and the British.
I think you need to examine that in a little more detail if we've got time for that. You need to see what was going on in Arnhem at that time.
Can you just give us the timings? I mean, what time was were these various things happening?
7 o'clock in the evening, local time. It was beginning to get dusk, and everyone confirms this 7 o'clock time that the British tanks, the Grenadiers, crossed over the bridge.
This is at Nijmegen?
At Nijmegen,
And what about the Arnhem Bridge? That fell, I think, around 10 in the evening, wasn't it?
In Arnhem, what happened on Wednesday the 20th, which is the critical day when...
That's that critical evening we're talking about, yeah.
In the morning, 7:30 in the morning, Colonel Frost, who was in charge of the 2nd Battalion, the only battalion that got through to Arnhem, by the way...
To the bridge, yeah.
Yeah, well, to the town, because they weren't actually on the bridge. Mm. They were...
Next to
the bridge in all the buildings, and they could control the bridge from the buildings. And of course, they did a very successful attack on the army that came across the bridge on the second day of the operation. That was the Monday the 18th, where they shot up a whole armoured unit, and that appeared on bridge too far.
Well, it left a load of wreckage across the bridge, which denied it to the Germans. They denied it to the Germans.
Well, the Germans couldn't go near it until the night of the 20th. What happened is, as I said, Colonel Frost got wounded on the 7:30 on the Wednesday the 20th, and was out of the battle. And Major Hibbert took over, he managed to maintain the defence successfully until 7 o'clock in the evening. The Germans were shooting up the houses and firing phosphorus shells into it. Brilliant. And they had to keep moving houses, but the Germans couldn't go across that. They couldn't cross that bridge safely until after dark. What happened is Hibbert had so many wounded in the cellars below his headquarters. He was on the third story, and the cellars had 200 or 300 wounded. He had to do something about the wounded.
Well, let's have a listen to Major Hibbert now, because there is a recording of him. So let's have a listen to hear his account of that evening, that fateful evening.
You had this wireless reception which came and went, and every now and again you got through to them, and I told them that Brigadier disappeared and that Johnny Frost would be commanding the brigade from now onwards, and that I would transmit his orders. About half an hour after that, at somewhere about 10 o'clock, I managed to get Brigadier Lathbury on the wireless radio, and I told him that we'd got about 600 men on the bridge and that we were holding the northern perimeter and that we had removed the charges on the bridge, but that we'd failed to get any troops south of the river. And I said that Lion Route, which was the southernmost route which we'd used, was still open. If you will send one battalion or one company from each battalion down Lion Route, there will be no opposition. I strongly recommend that you do one of these two things. And Brigadier Lathbury said, no, I've decided that we're in contact with the enemy and we're not really well organized at the moment, and my troops are too tired, and I will order them to stay where they are and make a determined attempt in first light, and I will come down Lion Route. And of course, that was the moment we lost the battle. If he had detached either one battalion or two companies to get onto the bridge, we'd have had enough troops on the bridge itself to hold out. On the bridge, we were overrun on about 10 o'clock on Wednesday night, the 20th, and at the same time, the Lord Carrington in his tanks had just got across Nijmegen Bridge. If we'd had probably that extra company or two companies on the north end of the bridge, we could have held out for those extra 2 or 3 hours which would have taken for our troops from the south to get up to us. I think it cost us the battle, because if he'd only sent us probably an extra two companies at that moment, that would have enabled us to widen the perimeter, which was the very small perimeter that we were holding, and that would have enabled us to stay hang on probably for another 12 hours at least.
That was Major Tony Hibbert there from the British 1st Airborne Division, who was actually at the bridge at Arnhem at that point and had been trying to coax his divisional commander to send a few more troops down, and saying that the route was open much earlier in the battle. Yeah. So saying, well, it would have been, you know, if they had had an extra couple of companies there, they could have held the bridge for much longer.
That raises quite a few issues, really. I suspect that there's too much pride at that time in some of the officers, and he didn't want to be told. He was a brigadier, by the way, in charge of 1st Brigade, and he'd stayed up in Oosterbeek managing the other battalions, and when it was perfectly easy for them to move down on the Lion Route, which was the southern of three routes. The other two routes, the north and the north and the middle, were not passable. But in Hibbert's book, he's written to say that that was a fatal error, not coming down Lion Route. The route was still open at that time, which was proved by the 2nd Platoon of the 9th Field Company Royal Engineers coming down during the night of the 17th, 18th. So they could have brought down another battalion or two companies, and that would have done the thing. And I think we've also got to look at the timing. If we've got a minute, we've got the Carrington or the Grenadiers crossing the Nijmegen Bridge, getting across down to Lent at 7 o'clock in the evening.
And we just heard Tony Hibbert there saying that actually they gave up. They basically finally ran out of ammunition at 10 o'clock that evening.
What happened?
There was a gap there of between 7 and 10 of 3 hours.
Yeah. The problem was Hibbert wanted to get the wounded seen to, and he arranged a truce at 7 o'clock with the Germans, and they ceased fire, and they were taking out the wounded. The Germans at that point were very humane about it, and it took about 3 hours until 10 o'clock. But what Hibbert found is, as they were evacuating the wounded, the Germans were infiltrating their positions, and they found by 10 o'clock that that it was all over, and they then had to try and escape from their positions.
Okay, but well, let's go back now
to... There was
to,
a three-hour window there, you see.
Yes, let's go back now to the Nijmegen Bridge, because there was a whole book written about that as well, about the Vaal crossing, by Tim Lynch. So let's have a listen to Tim now.
Okay, my name's Tim Lynch, and my book, Operation Market Garden, The Legend of the Vaal Crossing, is about the Battle of Nijmegen and the crossing of the river by the 82nd Airborne. And it looks really at the story that's grown up around that crossing, and particularly in respect of 30 Corps' advance to Arnhem. It's absolutely a heroic crossing. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about that. But the fact is, it was completely unnecessary. Had the 82nd actually achieved their objective on D-Day, the crossing would not have been necessary. It was something that the British had made contingency plans for, but for the 43rd Division to do the crossing rather than the 82nd. It was just that the 82nd happened to be there at the time.
Well, that's another angle on all this, Dave, isn't it? That actually the Americans didn't really do their job in Nijmegen by taking the bridge as they should have done.
Yeah, I think Tim is sort of underestimating the opposition at Nijmegen. There was a strong force up in the Groesbeck Heights, and half of the 82nd had to deal with them.
It's always with the benefit of hindsight. It's a little bit cheeky, isn't it? Even for us here and say this kind of thing. But certainly, I mean, the evidence from Heinz Harmel saying, I mean, he's actually what this German SS general said was that that the British made a mistake when they stayed in Lent in Nijmegen.
Of course they did.
If they had continued on, it would have been all over for us. I mean, this is what Robert Kershaw was saying, essentially, about the psychological impact.
People keep talking about there being four tanks at Nijmegen to go to Arnhem, which of course would be ridiculous, but the fact is there were at least 60 other tanks ready to go across there, and Carrington actually talks about that in his account. But I think one thing people don't realise is that there was a problem with aircraft getting enough airborne troops dropped in. Only half of the airborne troops that were available were actually dropped in. The other half were dropped in after it was all over, after it was too late to actually secure Arnhem.
Okay, well, Robert Kershaw's one of the last clips we're going to hear is from him. And one of the questions I asked him when I spoke to him yesterday was if the troops had actually got to Arnhem, would that have made a big difference? So let's see what he had to say about that.
Even if they had got there and they had relieved the British forces on the north side of the river, they were exhausted and they would not have had the resources to exploit the advantage that they would have achieved, because up until the 26th of September, bearing in mind that the bridge was captured on the 20th of September, the Arnhem Bridge by the Germans and the Nijmegen by the British, the corridor was cut three times for as long as 24, nearly 48 hours to the south. So they probably would not have been in a position to exploit beyond the bridgehead.
Well, what he's saying there, Dave, is it didn't really matter if they got there, because the Germans were cutting the supply lines for 30 Corps all the time, you know, as you're saying, there for up to and over even 24 hours. So even if they had got to Arnhem, there's no guarantee they could have held the town.
Well, he's got the date wrong there. He says that the bridge was captured on the 20th of September. It was captured on the 17th of December.
And what you've September. You've just got the... You said December. Right. It's September, yeah.
Yeah, it was the 17th of September. It was the 17th of September that the Arnhem Bridge was captured, whereas he said it was the 20th, so it doesn't make sense.
Maybe he's talking about the other bridge.
Hang on a minute. What we've also got to remember is the full scale of the battle. Dempsey was in charge of the overall thing. There were two more corps on either side. There was not only the 30th Corps coming through, there was the 8th Corps and the 12th Corps, which were
either side.
Now, if the Grenadiers had got into Arnhem, they could have held out until the other two corps crept up. So it doesn't make any sense, I'm afraid.
One of the things also I asked Robert was whether he thought this was a bad plan and whether it was Monty's fault, ultimately.
The Battle of Arnhem was not a series of Allied errors so much as the Germans were unexpectedly effective in providing the amount of resistance that was going to block the move, and all that was unexpected. And what is very interesting about Montgomery, it was a very daring plan, but Montgomery seems to have stepped back as soon as the operation had started and was starting to go wrong, and maybe he sensed that it was going to go wrong, because the Germans were providing really that much of a crust that was totally unanticipated. So I don't really buy the line that the problems at Arnhem were this great litany of Allied mistakes. I think they were unexpectedly confronted by far more serious German resistance than they anticipated, and they simply didn't have the resources as a consequence to carry it through.
What do you think of that then, Dave?
I don't agree with that at all. I think there were a series of mistakes, any one of which had had it not been made would have made the outcome more likely to have succeeded. First of all, as I said before, only 50% of the airborne forces actually got dropped in time, which was due to weather. What they should have done is they should have, when the weather was good, they should have made two trips, but the Brereton, who was commanding the air forces, refused to let that happen.
Well, this is one of the theses of Tim Lynch in his book, yeah, as well. He's saying that there was actually loads of rivalry between the Americans wanting to hang on to their air Dakotas.
Yeah, then we had the drop zones were too far. That could have been, it was a bit dodgy actually dropping straight on Arnhem, but some of the troops should have been, because there was nobody there to actually intercede, and they were afraid of being shot down by the anti-aircraft fire.
Yeah, one of the people I've read about was saying that actually it wasn't a bridge too far, it was just too far from the bridge.
I don't think it was I don't think it was a bridge too far. It was a bridge too far for some. I think that's what you can conclude. And I think it was Grenadier Guards and possibly Horrocks. And certainly Lieutenant General Boyd Browning, who's in charge of the three air divisions, was superfluous to requirements, basically.
But Heinz Hamel, really, for me, is one of the key people in this.
Absolutely.
If he's saying that actually it would have been all over for them if they pushed down the road, and they could easily have met up. Also, the other key bit of evidence are these artillery maps that show that there really were only a few security pickets at that time in those 3 hours between Arnhem and Nijmegen. So anyway, let's finish up by going back to listen to Sir Brian Urquhart, because we left him at the start, didn't we, if you remember. He was having a row, wasn't he, in the planning of Market Garden. So let's go back now to find out what transpired. And this is Sir Brian Urquhart, who was an intelligence officer in the army, helped plan Market Garden, and then after the war became a Secretary General of the newly formed United Nations.
I finally got sent away, I think, for a remark which turned out to be oddly prophetic, because our general, who was a very dashing figure called Boy Browning, said to Prince Bernard of the Netherlands that the Allied forces were going to advance into Germany over a carpet of airborne troops. And I said to our chief of staff, I wonder if they're going to be alive or dead airborne troops. This didn't go well at all. So everybody decided then that they'd had enough, and I got sent away. I asked if I could stay just as an ordinary officer in the operation. They said no. So you'll be court-martialed if you disobey orders. And everybody had enough trouble by that time, so I went. Well, the thing went very seriously wrong. And I then realized what I hadn't realized before, that these generals and great commanders and politicians who one so admired during the war were actually just like everybody else. They were vain, they were ambitious, they very often made extremely faulty judgments. I had not thought of that before. I had always thought they were kind of super people. And I must say that it remained with me for the rest of my life. I've never really trusted well-known, sort of glamorous leaders to really resist vanity and ambition and make the right mature decision and get it right. Well, I left the airborne business rather naturally after the Battle of Arnhem, because I was pretty unpopular. If you want to get really it's very unpopular to be the one person who opposes something that everybody else wants to do. But if you turn out to be right, you get seriously unpopular. And I was seriously unpopular because I was right. So I asked to be transferred.
So that was a final comment there from Sir Brian Urquhart, who later became a Secretary General, Secretary General of NATO. Anyway, thanks very much to Dave Barmby, who's been helping me with this today. Just to remind you, the book which really sparked this is that book by Robert Kershaw, It Never Snows in September. And Dave and I will be down Old Market tomorrow at 12 noon at Cut and Thrust War Games, doing a little talk and also having a go and seeing what could have happened if what Heitz Hahn was saying is true, and that there was only a few security pickets between Nijmegen and Arnhem. Now, that's all for the serious talk out of the way. Friday night is Music Night, 2 hours live now with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Bishopston, Dr. David Willingham, and to our reporter Marina Morris, also to Dave Barmby, former aide to David Cameron, if you can say. You were helping him when he was first becoming an MP a long, long time ago. So anyway, thank you very much for listening. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear us at thisweek.org.uk, or like every other show, we're there on the internet at bcfm.org.uk. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
And how we need refilling for our lives.